Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
More signs of life in the housing market, but is the buying activity anywhere near you? Get more into your pension, why it pays to contribute more, and transfer in protected rights, and the return of the 5% account for regular savers. All this to come in this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent, and I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Charlene Goff.
Hello.
Alice Ross.
Hello.
Steve Lodge.
Hello.
And our special studio guest, Tom McPhail, Head of Pensions Research at Hargreaves Lansdown.
Hello.
So let's start with this week's money news. The Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors' latest survey has reported a 10% increase in the number of house sales in August, back to the levels seen in spring 2008. A quarter of all estate agents have also reported that house prices in their area rose in the past 3 months. There's even been a small increase in the supply of properties on agents' books. Charlene, you and I have spent what seems like months on the phone to our respective estate agents trying to get our homes sold, but outside the exclusive media enclaves of London, how widespread is this increased activity?
Well, I think it started really in central London, which has seen some of the sharpest falls in prices, really suffered last year. And that seems to be where activity is starting to come back. It's not, interestingly, the really super prime parts of London, you know, the Knightsbridge or Belgravia, they're still, well, activity there is still quite slow. It's really the slightly cheaper areas that are still very prime in central and southwest London, so Chelsea and Fulham and Kensington and Notting Hill. And then it's kind of filtering out to parts of the southeast and southwest. Activity there is significantly ahead of last year. And gradually coming up through the rest of the country, though, I think parts of the north are still suffering.
So for those listeners north of Watford, is there likely to be a rolling out of this increased activity in the months ahead, or is it still too hard to say?
Well, actually, the opinion from agents is differing somewhat about the rest of the country. Savills has come out and said that even as far as York and Lincoln, they're seeing quite unseasonally high numbers of deals being done. And actually in July and August, there were three times the average in those markets. While in some of the prime southeast markets, like Tunbridge Wells and Sevenoaks, they've also seen sort of at least double the number of deals being done. But another agent, Chesterton Humbert, said those areas were still quite slow. So it really varies. And also this has got to be taken in context of last year, which was particularly bad, with the housing market really came to a complete standstill after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. So these figures are, you know, are looking rosier because of that. But there is some feeling that buyers are becoming a bit more confident.
Now, these activity levels being reported are, of course, coming from estate agents. What about the property auction market? Is there anything moving there?
Well, actually, that is seeing quite a lot of activity. And there was one residential auction held on Monday this week and 92% of lots were sold, and at some quite significantly higher prices. For example, one house had a guide price of £305,000 and actually sold for £100,000 more than that. So a real sign that buyers are looking for deals but are willing to pay slightly higher prices. And there also seems to be a lot more investors going to auction, and investors there for the first time. So quite a lot of new entrants coming in and trying to pick up a bargain. But these are still mainly the cash rich buyers, and people relying on mortgages are a bit more restrained, although there have been some quite good mortgage deals coming back onto the market this week, and a bit of a feeling that lenders are a bit more willing to lend. So that should help things over coming months.
And it certainly should help, I suppose, first-time buyers. The reason I asked that is that this is the week that this new interest-free loan scheme to cover your stamp duty is launched by Dragon's Den entrepreneur James Kahn, to a mixed reception, some suggesting that additional borrowing, not such a good idea if you're stretched anyway, others saying it could get you a better loan to value if your other costs are taken out. Do you think it'll make a difference?
Well, I think deals at the very high loan to value end are still quite hard to come by. There was some research out from Moneyfacts this week that showed, I think, a 15% increase in the number of mortgage deals across all loan to values, but you're looking at 90%, I think, or above 90%. There are only still a handful of lenders that will offer those sorts of deals. So there's a place for that, and we've been saying for a long time that, you know, we need more innovation, we need more help for first time buyers, and the fact that, you know, there's this loan which is interest free, so it won't add to the monthly cost for first time buyers could be a good thing. But I think people have to watch how much extra they borrow and when they can pay it back, because if they can't pay that back for a few years, I think the interest rate on that could become fairly steep.
Yeah, but I think any initiative that gets the market moving will warrant attention. Thanks for that, Charlene. And if you'd like to see a heat map of the whole country in terms of housing market activity, look out for Charlene's article in FT Money with the weekend FT. Still to come on the show, how to get 5% or thereabouts on your savings. First, though, pensions. If you read FT Money last week, you'll know that employees are being urged to act now to protect their company pensions as employers seek to cut costs by slashing benefits. Companies are reducing their contributions to staff schemes or even cutting them altogether as the recession hits. A survey by Standard Life has found that 1 in 10 companies with a defined contribution scheme has already cut benefits, while a further 18% are considering changes. But there are other ways to get more into a pension. In fact, it's almost a year since it's been possible to transfer protected rights pensions built up from national insurance rebates into your own self-invested scheme. So, Alice, there are ways to get your pension back on track.
Yes, and one of the ways that we've been looking at this week is by using protected rights that you've built up in other pension arrangements and putting them into a self-invested personal pension. So, Tom, maybe you could start by explaining what protected rights actually are.
Okay, so this is the money that you've built up in a private pension as a result of choosing to opt out of the government's second-tier pension system, what used to be called SERPs and is now called S2P, the state second pension. The government pays a rebate into a private pension arrangement for you, and this is the money that's called protected rights. And up until last October, there were restrictions on how you could invest this money. And then last October, the government said, right, you know, actually, we don't care anymore. You can move the money around if you want, and particularly, you can transfer that money into a self-invested personal pension if you want to.
And why were there these restrictions? They had to be kept in slightly safer funds, didn't they?
It was partly about the security of investments. A lot of it was to do with the fact that self-invested pensions, SIPs, used not to be regulated by the Financial Services Authority. So when the Financial Services Authority took over the regulation of SIPs, the government felt somewhat more relaxed about letting what were these replacement state benefits be invested into SIPs. So they said, OK, fine, you can now transfer the money across into a SIP if you want to.
But that said, I mean, SIPs have such a wide variety of possible investments. You could put it into presumably quite a high-risk emerging markets fund or something. And you've been tracking what investors have been doing with protected rights money in your SIP. What kind of things have they been putting it into?
Yes, I have. And I should point out that if you really want to set about losing money with your investments, you can do that pretty much wherever you're invested. So there's always scope for making injudicious investments. But it has been interesting looking at the investment choices that our clients have made in their protected rights SIPs, and there have been thousands of them in the last year. And they've made some pretty bold choices. So we've seen emerging market funds, specialist equity investment funds, and quite a lot of them choosing to go into banking stocks. Barclays and Lloyds Bank shares were two of the most popular investment choices by our protected rights SIP investors over the last year.
But of, you say, thousands of investors have put protected rights into their SIP, but presumably a large portion of people haven't moved their protected rights at all. What's your estimate on that?
No, that's right. So looking at our own experience, looking at the market turnover, I'm estimating that around 50,000 people have chosen to move their personal pension protected rights into a SIP in the last year. 50,000 is a lot of people, but to put it into context, there are somewhere between 8 and 10 million people who've got protected rights. That's millions of people who've got protected rights. So this is just a start, if you like.
So people could be doing a lot more with their pension in that respect. These millions of people could be moving their protected rights into a self-invested personal pension.
Absolutely. Now, for some of them, it will not be a good idea, but I think a lot of these people have got money sitting in dormant, very often underperforming insurance company managed funds. And really what I'd like to see everybody doing is reviewing their pension investments, taking a look at where their money's invested, what they're paying in charges, and then take a view from there on whether you can do better with your money, whether you should be looking to transfer it, or indeed leave it where it is because it's doing a good job now.
And of course, if you're reviewing your pension investments, you should also be looking at your company pension scheme. And that's also something that we've been looking at this week, because we found out that 1 in 10 company pension schemes with what's called a defined contribution scheme, where your employer matches what you put into the pension, has actually cut benefits since the recession started for their members. And a further 18% are thinking about cutting benefits, which doesn't really bode well for a lot of us. Is there anything that we can be doing about that?
I think you're absolutely right, and I think we'll see this trend continuing as the recession bites. We're going to see jobless numbers going up. The squeeze is still on, even if we do return to economic growth. Ultimately, your retirement income is dependent on what you do with the pension. You can look to your employer to help you, and so try and get the best contribution rates you can out of your employer. If they start cutting contributions, what else can you do? It's up to you to try and close the gap by increasing your contributions. So that's one step. If necessary, increase your contributions. Perhaps look to retire later. You can also look at things like salary sacrifice, which is a way of giving up your income, getting your employer to pay money into your pension instead of giving it to you as your salary. It's very tax efficient to do that. So if your employer will play ball, it's a good idea. There are knock-on implications for that, but that's one thing you can look at.
But Tom, I remain bemused at how employers can get away with cutting what, at the end of the day, is deferred pay. That's what pensions are. I mean, are employment contracts now so flaky that we shouldn't have trade unions and employees suing their employers left, right and centre over these effective pay cuts?
The pensions are deferred pay. And employers have to consult with their employees. They can't simply announce one day, I'm cutting your pension contributions. At the end of the day, if it's a question of would you like a job or would you like to see a cut in your pension contributions, when push comes to shove, it's generally the pension contribution that's going to suffer from that. So yes, you have to go through consultation. You can negotiate with your employer, but if they really, really need or want to cut your contributions, they do have the scope to do that.
Which I suppose leaves everybody needing to look at the alternatives that you've mentioned, salary sacrifice, higher contributions.
Absolutely. And ultimately, what you get from retirement is going to be what it's down to you. So you need to look at what you're paying in, what your employer's paying in, and make sure that it's enough. And use these tricks, if you can, to try and improve the contribution rates.
Well, thanks very much, Tom and Alice. And you can read Alice's 8-step guide to getting more into your pension, be it a SIP or a company scheme, before it's too late, in FT Money this weekend and online at ft.com/money. And finally today, savings accounts. One-year bonds offering 5% interest on deposits have long since disappeared, with the average one-year deal now paying just 3.11%, according to the latest figures from MoneyFacts. But it is still possible to get 5% or thereabouts if you can be disciplined by being a regular saver or committing to a longer term with a get-out clause. So, Steve, what are the best deals out there right now for people needing that sort of level of interest?
Well, absolutely, Matthew. You're absolutely right that 5% is not available everywhere by any means. No surprise, base rate is 0.5%. Instant access accounts, most of them are paying less than 1%. But we've talked before about these regular saver accounts, these tortoises of the investment world, where you save every month. You can only save typically up to £250 a month or £500 a month, but they do offer very good rates. There's quite a few out there currently offering 5%. Halifax, Royal Bank of Scotland, NatWest, Norwich and Peterborough Building Society, all offering fixed rates of 5% for a year. You're only tied in for a year as well. And the catch that people often refer to as well about, but, you know, that's not very much money. Well, frankly, I don't know how much spare cash you have left at the end of the month.
Not much.
Exactly. And you could always open all four of those. So there already you've got in excess of £1,000 you could save. So from my perspective, they're a very good, sleep easy way of saving and a very good savings discipline, because you just set up the standing order, come back in a year's time, and hey presto, you've got a nice little nest egg with a bit of interest on top that has been accruing at a good rate.
But if, unlike me, you've got a large lump sum that you're looking to get in and earn 5% on, it is now the case that you've got to tie it up for 5 years. Is there any way around that?
You're right, Matthew. I mean, we've written recently about the removal of some very good rates, 5% plus rates on 3-year bonds, tying you in for 3 years. And it's true that as people have turned to fixed rates, as generally instant access and other savings rates have fallen in the last 6 months, people have said, I'm not sure about tying my money up for 5 years. You know, I don't even know what I'm doing next Tuesday, let alone in 5 years' time. But if you look at the fine detail of some of these 5-year bonds, the tie-in is not quite as exacting as you'd expect. Birmingham Midshires, for example, and Saga, which I think is effectively the same product, offer a 90-day interest penalty if you want to come out early. So some experts there are mulling this idea that you could go in now, get that premium 5%, 5.15, I think, in one case, over 5 years rate, take that for the next year or two before base rates start turning up, more savings rates come up. If suddenly we get a huge rush up in savings rates beyond above that 5% and your 5% then looks unattractive, then fine. Pay the 90-day penalty. You're effectively giving up 1.3% of your interest, only taking you back to about 4% for that last year, and then move into that high-paying account.
And if the best you can get on a one-year bond is just over 3%, which is that was the average figure I was giving. Yes, the average is just over 3%, but you can get up close to 4%. You get no worse deal by taking this 90-day penalty, do you?
Absolutely, that's one way of thinking about it. I mean, you do need to work through the arithmetic. I mean, as one expert said to me this week, the analogy is with being tied into a mortgage and having an early repayment charge. Some people have thought about this when they've been tied into sort of high fixed-rate mortgages. You pay your remortgage charge. You really got to go through the arithmetic. What do I pay? What would I gain by switching to the new deal? And as with mortgages, so with savings, the bigger the balance you have, the greater the potential benefit in going through that hassle. But it is important to sit down. But in summary, I mean, the point is, do not rule out, just because it says 5 years on the tin, have a look inside the tin and there might be something a little bit better.
And just looking a little bit further ahead, we've seen 5% bonds come and go. Is there a view that in the future we may see interest rates creep up a year's time, 2 years' time?
Yes. I mean, there's incredibly intense competition at the moment. So you can't rule out short-term increases. But many people would say where we're at now, which is, you know, up to about 5 at best on fixed rates, up to about 3 or just over on instant access, you're not going to see much increase over that, barring a big change in the base rate in the wider interest rate environment. City experts, of course, tell us that base rates ain't going nowhere this year, and possibly, some would say, not even next year or sort of later into next year. So you're potentially looking at a period, and you've already had 6 months of base rate stability at this record low of 0.5%. That period may last 1, even possibly 2 years in total. When base rates do come back, some analysts would say that banks will try not to pass on those rate increases. But at the same time, they're desperate for cash, so they no doubt will find various areas of the market. But one thing to realise about the whole savings market, just as in the investment world, in the stock market world, over different periods of time, there's almost a rotation into different types of accounts. Right now, regular savings accounts and some of these 5-year bonds look attractive. Earlier this year, 2-year bonds looked very attractive. Just weeks ago, 3-year bonds. In the next few weeks, maybe ISAs with the October allowance increase. So it's you've got to keep your eyes on your rate, basically, and what's available out there.
So keep your eye on the market, or better still, have Steve do it for you, which he has done for this weekend's FT Money. So if you'd like to know more about the best of those savings rates that he's mentioned, look out for his article in FT Money with Weekend FT and online at ft.com/money. But that's all for this week's FT Money show. Remember, you can find all of these stories and weekday news on the website at the address I've just given. And you can read and comment on our latest blog posts at ft.com/money matters. We'll be back next week with another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Steve, Alice, Charlene and Tom McPhail from Hargreaves Lansdown.
Goodbye. Bye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.